This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents Relic by Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child.
To Charles Crumley, D.P. To Lucci, who came along for the ride, and in memory of Nora and Gaga, L.C. Acknowledgements. The authors wish to express their thanks to the following persons who generously lent me their time and or expertise in helping to make Relic the book it is. Ken Goddard, Tom Daugherty, Bob Gleason, Harvey Klinger, Anna McGee, Camille Klein, Dennis Kelly, Georgette Peligian, Michael O'Connor, Karina De Leon, Lou Peretti, and Harry Trumbore. Relic. Introduction. 1. The Amazon Basin, September 1987. At noon, the clouds clinging to the top of Cerro Gordo broke free and scattered. Far above, in the upper reaches of the forest canopy, Whittlesea could see golden tints of sunlight. Animals, probably spider monkeys, thrashed and hooted above his head, and a macaw swooped low, squawking obscenely. Whittlesea stopped next to a fallen jacaranda tree and watched Carlos, his sweating camp assistant, catch up.
"We will stop here," he said in Spanish. "Baja la caja. Put down the box."
Whittlesea sat down on the fallen tree and pulled off his right boot and sock. Lighting a cigarette, he applied its tip to the forest of ticks on his shin and ankle. Carlos unshouldered an old army pack board on which a wooden crate was awkwardly lashed.
"Open it, please," said Whittlesea.
Carlos removed the ropes, unsnapped a series of small brass clasps, and pulled off the top. The contents were packed tightly with the fibers of an indigenous plant. Whittlesea pulled aside the fibers, exposing some artifacts, a small wooden plant press, and a stained leather journal. He hesitated a moment, then drew a small but exquisitely carved figurine of a beast from the shirt pocket of his field jacket. He hefted the artifact in his hand, admiring again its workmanship, its unnatural heaviness. Then he placed it reluctantly in the crate, covered everything with the fibers, and reattached the lid. From his rucksack, Whittlesea took out a folded sheet of blank paper, which he opened on his knee. He brought a battered gold pen out of his shirt pocket and began writing. Upper Xingu, September 17th, 1987. Montague, I've decided to send Carlos back with the last crate and go on alone in search of Crocker. Carlos is trustworthy, and I can't risk losing the crate should anything happen to me. Take note of the shaman's rattle and other ritual objects. They seem unique. But the figurine I've enclosed, which we found in a deserted hut at this site, is the proof I've been looking for. Note the exaggerated claws, the reptilian attributes, the hints at bipedalia. The Kothoga exist, and the Mbun legend is not mere fabrication. All my field notes are in this notebook. It also contains a complete account of the breakup of the expedition, which you will, of course, know about by the time this reaches you. Whittlesea shook his head, remembering the scene that had played itself out the day before. That idiotic bastard, Maxwell. All he'd cared about was getting those specimens he'd stumbled on back to the museum undamaged. Whittlesea laughed silently to himself. Ancient eggs. As if they were anything more than worthless seed pods. Maxwell should have been a paleobiologist instead of a physical anthropologist. How ironic they'd packed up and left a mere 1,000 yards from his own discovery. In any case, Maxwell was gone now, and the others with him. Only Carlos and Crocker, and two guides, had stayed. Now there was just Carlos. Whittlesea returned to the note. Use my notebook and the artifacts as you see fit to help restore my good standing with the museum. But above all else, take care of this figurine. I am convinced that its worth to anthropology is incalculable. We discovered it yesterday by accident. it seems to be the centerpiece of the Mbuin cult. However, there is no other trace of habitation nearby. This strikes me as odd. Whittlesey paused. He hadn't described the discovery of the figurine in his field notes. Even now, his mind resisted the memory. Crocker had wandered off the trail for a better look at a jacamar. Otherwise, they'd never have found the hidden path slanting down steeply between moss-slick walls. Then that crude hut, half buried among ancient trees, in the wet vale where daylight barely penetrated. The two Botokudo guides, normally chattering non-stop to each other in Tupian, shot up immediately. When questioned by Carlos, one of them just muttered something about a guardian of the hut and a curse on anybody who violated its secrets. Then, for the first time, Whittlesey had heard them speak the word Kothoga. Kothoga. The Shadow People. Whittlesey was skeptical. He'd heard talk of curses before, usually right before a request for higher wages. But when he emerged from the hut, the guides were gone. Then that old woman, blundering out of the forest. She was probably Yanomamo, obviously not Kothoga. But she knew of them. She had seen them. The curses she'd hinted at. And the way she'd just melted back into the forest, more like a jaguar yearling than a septuagenarian. Then they turned their attention to the hut. The hut. Gingerly, Whittlesey allowed himself to remember. It was flanked by two stone tablets with identical carvings of a beast sitting on its haunches. Its claw held something weathered and indistinguishable. Behind the hut lay an overgrown garden, a bizarre oasis of bright color amid the green fastness. The floor of the hut was sunken several feet, and Crocker almost broke his neck on the way in. Whittlesey followed him more carefully, while Carlos simply knelt in the entranceway. The air inside was dark and cool, and smelt of decaying earth. Switching on his flashlight, Whittlesey saw the figurine sitting on a tall earthen mound in the middle of the hut. Around its base lay a number of strangely carved discs. Then the flashlight reached the walls. The hut had been lined with human skulls. Examining a few of the closest, Whittlesey noticed deep scratch marks he could not immediately understand. Ragged holes yawned through the tops. In many cases, the occipital bone at the base of the skull was also smashed and broken off, the heavy squamosa bones completely gone. His hand shook, and the flashlight failed. Before he switched it on again, he saw dim light filtering through the thousands of eye sockets, dust motes swimming sluggishly in the heavy air. Afterward, Crocker decided he needed a short walk, to be alone for a while, he'd told Whittlesey. But he hadn't come back. The vegetation here is very unusual. The cycads and ferns look almost primordial. Too bad there isn't time for more careful study. We've used a particularly resilient variety as packing material for the crates. Feel free to let Jorgensen take a look if he's interested. I fully expect to be with you at the Explorers Club a month from now, celebrating our success with a brace of dry martinis and a good macanudo. Until then, I know I can entrust this material and my reputation to you. Your colleague, Whittlesey. He inserted the letter beneath the lid of the crate. Carlos, he said, I want you to take this crate back to Puerto del Mos and wait for me there. If I'm not back in 2 weeks, talk to Colonel Soto. Tell him to ship it back with the rest of the crates by air to the museum, as agreed. He will draw your wages. Carlos looked at him. I do not understand, he said. You will stay here alone. Whittlesey smiled, lit a second cigarette, and resumed killing ticks. Someone has to bring the crate out. You should be able to catch up with Maxwell before the river. I want a couple of days to search for Crocker. Carlos slapped his knee.
Es loco! I can't leave you alone. Si te dejo atrás, te morirías. You will die here in the forest, señor, and your bones will be left to the howling monkeys. We must go back together. That is best.
Whittlesey shook his head impatiently. "Give me the mercurochrome and the quinine, and the dried beef from your pack," he said, pulling the filthy sock back on and lacing his boot. Carlos started unpacking, still protesting. Whittlesey ignored him, absently scratching insect bites on the back of his neck and staring up toward Cerro Gordo.
"They will wonder, senor. They will think I left you. It will be very bad for me," Carlos said rapidly, placing the items in Whittlesey's pack. "The Kaburi flies will eat you alive," he continued, moving over to the crate and lashing it shut. "You will catch malaria again and die this time. I will stay with you."
Whittlesey stared at the shock of snow-white hair plastered to Carlos's sweaty forehead. That hair had been pure black yesterday, before Carlos looked into the hut. Carlos met his gaze for a moment, then lowered his eyes. Whittlesey stood up.
"Adios," he said, and disappeared into the bush.
By late afternoon, Whittlesey noticed that the thick, low clouds had returned to shroud Cerro Gordo. For the last several miles, he had been following an ancient trail of unknown origin, barely a narrow alley in the brush. The trail cleverly worked its way through the blackwater swamp surrounding the base of the Tepuy, the soggy, jungle-clotted plateau that lay ahead. The trail had the logic of a human trail, Whittlesey thought. It moved with obvious purpose. Animal tracks often wandered. And it was heading for a steep ravine in the shoulder of the approaching Tepuy. Crocker must have come this way. He stopped to consider, unconsciously fingering the talisman, a gold arrow overlaid by another of silver, that had hung around his neck since childhood. Besides the hut, they'd seen no sign of human habitation for the last several days except the long-deserted root-gatherer village. Only the Katoga could have created this path. As he approached the plateau, he could see a few braids of water cascading down its steep flanks. He would camp at the bottom tonight and make the 1,000-meter ascent in the morning. It would be steep, muddy, and possibly dangerous. If he met the Katoga, well, he would be trapped. But he had no reason to think the Katoga tribe was savage. After all, it was this other creature, Mbun, to which local myth cycles ascribed all the killing and savagery. Strange. An unknown creature, supposedly controlled by a tribe nobody had seen. Could Mbun actually exist? He wondered. Conceivably, a small remnant could be alive in this vast rainforest. The area was virtually unexplored by biologists. Not for the first time, he wished that Crocker hadn't taken his own Mannlicher 30-06 when he'd left camp. But first, Whittlesey realized he had to locate Crocker. Then he could search for the Katoga, prove they hadn't died out centuries before. He'd be famous, the discoverer of an ancient people living in a kind of Stone Age purity deep in the Amazon, on a plateau that floated above the jungle like Arthur Conan Doyle's The Lost World. There was no reason to fear the Katoga. Except that hut. Suddenly, a sharp, sickly smell assailed his nostrils, and he stopped. There was no mistaking it. A dead animal, and a big one. He took a dozen steps as the smell intensified. His heart quickened with anticipation. Perhaps the Katoga had butchered an animal nearby. There might be artifacts left at the site, tools, weapons, perhaps even something ceremonial in nature. He crept forward. The sweet, nauseating reek grew stronger. He could see sunlight in a patch of canopy high above his head, the sure sign of a nearby clearing. He stopped and tightened his pack, not wanting to be hampered in case he had to move fast. The narrow trail, walled in by bush, leveled off and took a sudden turn into the head of the small clearing. There, on the opposite side, was the carcass of the animal. The base of the tree it lay against had been ritually carved with a spiral, and a bundle of bright green parrot feathers lay on top of the gaping, greasy brown rib cage. But as he walked closer, he saw that the carcass was wearing a khaki shirt. A cloud of fat flies roared and swarmed about the open rib cage. Whittlesey noticed that a severed left arm was lashed to the tree trunk with a fibrous rope, the palm sliced open. A number of spent cartridge casings lay around the body. Then he saw the head. It lay face up under the corpse's armpit, the back of the skull torn away, the cloudy eyes staring upward, the cheeks bulging. Whittlesey had found Crocker. Instinctively, Whittlesey began stumbling backward. He saw how rows of claws had flayed the body with obscene, inhuman strength. The corpse looked stiff. Perhaps if God was merciful, the Kathoga had already departed. Assuming it was the Kathoga. Then he noticed that the rainforest, normally overflowing with the sounds of life, was silent. With a start, he turned to face the jungle. Something was moving in the towering brush at the edge of the clearing, and two slitted eyes, the color of liquid fire, took shape between the leaves. With a sob and a curse, he drew his sleeve across his face and looked again. The eyes had vanished. There was no time to lose. He had to get back down the trail, away from this place. His path back into the forest lay directly ahead. He'd have to make a run for it. Just then he saw something on the ground he hadn't noticed before, and he heard movement, ponderous yet horrifyingly stealthy, through the brush in front of him. 2. Belém, Brazil, July 1988. This time, Van was pretty sure the dock foreman was on to him. He stood well back in the shadows of the warehouse alley, watching. Light rain obscured the bulky outlines of the tethered freighters and narrowed the dock lights into pinpoints. Steam rose as the rain hit the hot deck boards, bringing with it the faint odor of creosote. From behind him came the nocturnal sounds of the port, the staccato bark of a dog, faint laughter leavened with Portuguese phrases, calypso music from the waterfront bars on the Avenida. It had been such a sweet deal. He'd come down when Miami got too hot, taking the long route. Here it was mostly light trade, small freighters bound up and down the coast. The dock crew always needed stevedores, and he'd loaded boats before. He'd said his name was Van Stevens, and no one questioned it. They wouldn't have believed a first name of Stevenson, anyway. The setup here had all the right ingredients. He'd had plenty of practice in Miami, plenty of time to sharpen his instincts. Those instincts paid off down here. Deliberately, he spoke Portuguese badly, haltingly, so he could read eyes and gauge responses. Ricon, junior assistant to the harbor master, was the last link Van had needed. Van was alerted when a shipment was coming in from upriver. Usually, he'd just be given two names, incoming and outgoing. He always knew what to look for. The boxes were always the same. He'd see that they were safely offloaded and stowed in the warehouse. Then, he just made sure they were the last cargo loaded onto the designated freighter headed for the States. Venn was naturally cautious. He'd kept a close eye on the dock foreman. Once or twice he'd had a feeling, like a warning bell in his brain, that the foreman suspected something. But each time, Van had eased up a little, and in a few weeks the warning bell had gone away. Now he checked his watch. 11 o'clock. He heard a door opening, then closing, from around the corner. Van drew himself up against the wall. Heavy footfalls sounded against wooden planking. Then the familiar form passed under a streetlight. When the footsteps receded, Van peered around the corner. The office was dark, deserted, as he knew it would be. With a last glance, he edged around the corner of the building onto the docks. An empty backpack slapped damply against his shoulders with each step. As he walked, Van reached into a pocket, withdrew a key, and clenched it tightly. That key was his lifeline. Before he'd spent 2 days on the docks, he'd had an impression made of it. Then passed a small freighter berthed along the wharf, its heavy hawsers dripping black water onto rusted bits. The ship seemed deserted, not even a harbor watch on deck. He slowed. The warehouse door lay directly ahead, near the end of the main pier. Then glanced quickly over his shoulder. Then, with a quick turn of his hand, he unlocked the metal door and slipped inside. Pulling the door closed, he let his eyes grow accustomed to the darkness. Halfway home. He just had to finish up in here and get the hell out. As soon as possible. Because Rickon was growing greedy, Cruzeros running through his hands like water. Last time, he'd made a crack about the size of his cut. Just that morning, Rickon and the foreman had been talking fast and low, the foreman looking over at Ven. Now, Ven's instincts told him to get away. Inside, he saw the darkened warehouse resolve itself into a vague landscape of cargo containers and packing crates. He couldn't chance a flashlight, but it didn't matter. He knew the layout well enough to walk it in his dreams. He moved forward carefully, threading a path through the vast mountains of cargo. At last, he saw the landmark he'd been waiting for. A battered-looking stack of crates, six large and one small, stacked in a forlorn corner. Two of the larger crates were stenciled MNH, New York. Months before, Van had asked about these crates. The quartermaster's boy had told him the story. Seemed the crates had come downriver from Puerto de Mos the previous fall. They'd been scheduled for air shipment to a New York museum, but something had happened to the people who'd made the arrangements. The apprentice couldn't say exactly what. But payment hadn't come through in time, and now the crates were snarled in a mass of government red tape and local kickbacks, seemingly forgotten. Except by Van. There was just enough room behind the forgotten crates for him to stash his shipments until the outgoing freighters were loading. The warm night breeze came in from a broken window high in the wall, stirring the sweat on Ven's forehead. He smiled in the darkness. Just the other week, he'd learned that soon the crates would finally be shipped back to the States. But he'd be long gone by then. Now, he checked his own cache. Just a single box this time, whose contents would fit nicely into the corners of his backpack. He knew where the markets were and what to do. And he'd be doing it. Somewhere far away, very soon. As he was about to squeeze behind the large crates, Van stopped abruptly. There was a strange odor here, something earthy, goatish, decaying. A lot of odd cargoes had come through the port, but none smelling quite like this. His instincts were going off five alarm, yet he couldn't detect anything wrong or out of place. He slid forward between the museum cargo and the wall. He stopped again. Something wasn't right back here. Something wasn't right at all. He heard, rather than saw, something moving in the cramped space. The pungent odor welled forward, blanketing him with its rotten stench. Suddenly, he was slammed against the wall with terrific force. Pain exploded in his chest and gut. He opened his mouth to scream, but something was boiling in his throat. And then a stab like lightning tore through his skull, leaving only darkness behind. Museum of Unnatural Mystery Part 1 3 New York, present day. The red-haired kid was clambering onto the platform, calling his younger brother a chicken, reaching toward the elephant's foot. Juan eyed him silently, easing himself forward just as the kid's hand touched the exhibit.
"Yo!"
Juan yelled, breaking into a trot.
"Hey, no touching the elephants!"
The boy looked scared and snatched back his hand. He was still at an age where a uniform impressed him. Older ones, 15, 16, would give Juan the finger sometimes. They knew he was only a museum guard. Lousy fucking job. One of these days he was going to finish that equivalency shit and take the police exam. He watched suspiciously as Red Hair and Little Brother walked around the cases in the darkened hall, looking at the stuffed lions. At the case full of chimps, the boy started hooting and scratching under his arms, showing off for Junior's benefit. Where the hell were the parents? Now Billy, the redhead, tugged his little brother into a chamber filled with African artifacts. A row of masks with flat wooden teeth leered at them from a showcase.
"Wow!" exclaimed Billy's kid brother.
"That's dumb," said Billy. "We're going to see the dinosaurs."
"Where's Mommy?"
said the kid, screwing his head around.
"Ah, she got lost," said Billy. "Come on."
They began to move through a vast, echoing hall filled with totem poles. At the far end, a woman holding a red flag was leading the final tour group of the day, her voice shrill. To Billy's younger brother, the hall smelled faintly spooky, like smoke and old tree roots. When the group disappeared around a corner, the hall fell silent. The last time they had been there, Billy remembered, they had seen the biggest brontosaurus in the world, and a tyrannosaurus and a trachydent. At least, that's what he thought it was called, a trachydent. The teeth on the tyrannosaurus must have been 10 feet long. That was just about the greatest thing Billy had ever seen. But he didn't remember seeing these totem poles. Maybe the dinosaurs were through the next door. But that led only to the boring hall of Pacific peoples, full of jades and ivories and silks and bronze statues. "Now look what you did," said Billy.
"What?"
"You made me get lost, that's what," said Billy.
"Mommy's going to be real mad," the kid said.
Billy snorted. They weren't supposed to meet his parents until closing time on the big front steps. He'd find his way out, no problem. They wound through several more dusty rooms, down a narrow flight of stairs, and into a long, dim hall. Thousands of little stuffed birds lined the walls from floor to ceiling, white cotton poking out of sightless eyes. The hall was empty and smelled of mothballs.
"I know where we are," said Billy, hopefully, peering into the dimness.
The kid started to snuffle.
"Shut up,"
said Billy. The snuffling stopped. The hall took a sharp dogleg, ending in a darkened cul-de-sac full of dust and empty display cases. There were no visible exits except back through the long hall of dead birds. The footfalls of the children echoed hollowly, far from the other Sunday tourists. Against the far side of the chamber stood a rolling barricade of canvas and wood, pretending unsuccessfully to be a wall. Letting go of his brother's hand, Billy walked up and peered behind the barricade.
"I've been here before," he said confidently. "They've closed this place off, but it was open last time. I bet we're right below the dinosaurs. Let me see if there's a way up." "You're not supposed to go back there,"
the kid brother warned.
"Listen, stupid, I'm going, and you'd better wait."
Billy ducked behind the barricade, and a few moments later the kid heard the squeal of metal as a door was pulled open.
"Hey!"
came Billy's voice.
"There's a spiral staircase here. It only goes down, but it's cool. I'm going to try it out."
"Don't, Billy!"
the kid cried, but the only answer was retreating footsteps. The kid started to bawl, his thin voice rising in the gloom of the hall. After a few minutes, he fell to hiccuping, sniffed loudly, and sat down on the floor. He started pulling on a little flap of rubber that was coming off the toe of his sneaker, working it loose. Suddenly, he looked up. The hall was silent and airless. The lights in the cases threw black shadows on the floor. A forced air ducked, thumped, and began to rumble somewhere. Billy was gone for real now. The kid started to cry again, louder this time. Maybe it would be okay if he followed Billy. Maybe it wasn't such a scary thing after all. Maybe Billy had gone ahead and found his parents, and they were waiting for him there on the other side. But he had to hurry. The museum was probably closed by now. He stood up and slipped behind the partition. The hall continued on, the cases filled with the dust and mold of long-neglected exhibits. An ancient metal door on one side of the hall was slightly ajar. The kid walked up to it and peered in. Behind the door was the top landing of a narrow spiral staircase that circled downward out of sight. It was even dustier here, and there was a strange smell in the air that made his nose wrinkle. He didn't want to stand on those steps at all, but Billy was down there.
"Billy! Billy, come up! Please!"
In the cavernous gloom, his echoes were the only answer. The child sniffled, then gripped the railing and began walking slowly down into darkness. 4. Monday. As Margot Green rounded the corner of West 72nd Street, the early morning sun struck her square in the face. She looked down a minute, blinking. Then, tossing her brown hair back, she crossed the street. The New York Museum of Natural History loomed before her like an ancient fortress, its vast Beaux-Arts facade climbing ponderously above a row of copper benches. Margot turned down the cobbled driveway that led to the staff entrance. She walked past a loading dock and headed for the granite tunnel leading to the interior courtyards of the museum. Then she slowed, wary. Flickering stripes of red light were painting the mouth of the tunnel in front of her. At the far end, she could see ambulances, police cars, and an emergency services vehicle all parked at random. Margot entered the tunnel and walked toward a glass pillbox. Normally, old Curly the guard would be dozing in his chair at this time of the morning, propped up against the pillbox corner, a blackened calabash pipe resting on his ample front. But today he was awake and standing. He slid the door open.
"Morning, doctor," he said.
He called everyone doctor, from graduate students to the museum director, whether they owned that title or not.
"What's up?" Margot asked.
"Don't know," Curly said. "They just got here 2 minutes ago. But I guess I better see your ID this time."
Margot rummaged in her carry-all, wondering if she even had her ID. It had been months since someone had asked to see it.
"I'm not sure I've got it with me,"
she said, annoyed that she hadn't cleaned her bag of last winter's detritus. Her carry-all had recently won messiest bag in the museum status from her friends in the anthro department. The pillbox telephone rang and Curly reached for it. Margot found her ID and held it up to the window, but Curly ignored her, his eyes wide as he listened to the receiver. He put it down without saying a word, his whole body rigidly at attention.
"Well?" Margot asked. "What's happened?"
Curly removed his pipe.
"You don't want to know," he said.
The phone rang again and Curly grabbed it. Margot had never seen the guard move so quickly. She shrugged, dropped the ID back in her bag, and walked on. The next chapter of her dissertation was coming due, and she couldn't afford to lose a single day. The week before had been a write-off, the service for her father, the formalities, the phone calls. Now she couldn't lose any more time. Crossing the courtyard, she entered the museum through the staff door, turned right, and hurried down a long basement corridor toward the anthropology department. The various staff offices were dark, as they always were until 9:30 or 10 o'clock. The corridor took an abrupt right angle, and she stopped. A band of yellow plastic tape was stretched across the corridor. Margot could make out the printing. NYPD crime scene, do not cross. Jimmy, a guard usually assigned to the Peruvian Gold Hall, was standing in front of the tape with Gregory Kawakita, a young assistant curator in the evolutionary biology department.
"What's going on here?" Margot asked.
"Typical museum efficiency," Kawakita said with a wry smile. "We've been locked out."
"Nobody's told me nothing except to keep everyone out,"
the guard said nervously.
"Look," Kawakita said, "I'm giving a presentation to the NSF tomorrow, and this day's going to be a long one. Now, if you'll let me..."
Jimmy looked uncomfortable.
"I'm just doing my job, okay?"
"Come on," Margot said to Kawakita.
"Let's get some coffee up in the staff lounge. Maybe someone there will know what's going on. First, I want to hunt down a men's room if I can find one that isn't sealed off," Kawakita responded irritably. "I'll meet you there."
The door to the staff lounge, which was never closed, was closed today. Margot put her hand on the knob, wondering if she should wait for Kawakita. Then she opened the door. It would be a cold day in hell when she needed him as a backup. Inside, two policemen were talking, their backs turned to her. One sniggered.
"What was that, number 6? He said.
"Lost count," the other replied. "But he can't have any more breakfast to bring up."
As the officers moved apart, Margot got a look at the lounge behind them. The large room was deserted. In the kitchen area at the far end, someone was leaning over the sink. He spat, wiped his mouth, and turned around. Margot recognized Charlie Prine, the new conservation expert in the anthro department, hired on a temporary grant 6 months before to restore objects for the new exhibition. His face was ashen and expressionless. Moving to Prine's side, the officers propelled him gently forward. Margot stood aside to let the group pass. Prine walked stiffly, like a robot, Instinctively, Margot's eyes traveled downward. Prine's shoes were soaked in blood. Watching her vacantly, Prine registered the change of expression. His eyes followed hers. Then he stopped so suddenly that the cop behind plowed into his back. Prine's eyes grew large and white. The policeman grabbed his arms, and he resisted, neighing in panic. Quickly, they moved him out of the room. Margot leaned against the wall, willing her heart to slow down as Kawakita came in, followed by several others. "Hoth's museum must be sealed off," he said, shaking his head and pouring himself a cup of coffee. "Nobody can get into their offices." As if on cue, the museum's ancient PA system wheezed into operation.
"Attention, please. All non-support personnel currently on the premises, please report to the staff lounge."
As they sat down, more staffers entered in twos and threes. Lab technicians for the most part, and assistant curators without tenure, too early for the really important people. Margot watched them detachedly. Kawakita was talking, but she couldn't hear him. Within 10 minutes, the room was packed. Everyone was talking at once, expressing outrage that their offices were off-limits, complaining about how no one was telling them anything, discussing each new rumor in shocked tones. Clearly, in a museum where nothing exciting ever seemed to happen, they were having the time of their lives. Kawakita gulped his coffee, made a face. "Will you look at that sediment?" he said. He turned towards her. "Been struck dumb, Margot. You haven't said a word since we sat down." Haltingly, she told him about Prine. Kawakita's handsome features narrowed.
"My God," he finally said, "what do you suppose happened?"
As his baritone voice boomed, Margot realized that the conversation in the lounge had died away. A heavy-set, balding man in a brown suit was standing in the doorway, a police radio shoved into one pocket of his ill-fitting jacket, an unlit cigar protruding from his mouth. Now he strode through, followed by two uniformed policemen. He centered himself at the front of the room, hiked up his pants, removed his cigar, picked a piece of tobacco off his tongue, and cleared his throat.
"May I have your attention, please?" he said. "A situation has arisen that's going to require you to bear with us for a while."
Suddenly, a voice rang out accusingly from the back of the room.
"Excuse me, Mr....
Margot craned her neck over the crowd.
"Freed,"
Kawakita whispered. Margot had heard of Frank Freed, a testy ichthyology curator. The man in brown turned to look at Freed.
"Lieutenant D'Agosta," he rapped out. "New York City Police Department."
It was a reply that would have shut most people up. Freed, an emaciated man with long gray hair, was undaunted.
"Perhaps," he said sarcastically, "we may be informed of what exactly is going on around here. I think we have a right..."
"I'd like to brief you on what happened," D'Agosta resumed. "But at this point, all we can say is that a body has been found on the premises under circumstances we are currently investigating. If..."
At the explosion of talk, D'Agosta wearily held up his hand.
"I can only tell you that a homicide squad is on the scene and that an investigation is in progress," he continued. "Effective immediately, the museum is closed. For the time being, no one may enter and no one may leave. We expect this to be a very temporary condition." He paused. "If a homicide has occurred, there is a possibility, that the killer is still inside the museum. We would merely ask you to remain here an hour or two while a sweep is conducted. A police officer will be around to take your names and titles."
In the stunned silence that followed, he left the room, closing the door behind him. One of the remaining policemen dragged a chair over to the door and sat down heavily in it. Slowly, the conversations began to resume.
"We're being locked in here," Freed cried out. "This is outrageous."
"Jesus," Margot breathed.
"You don't suppose Prine is a murderer?"
"Scary thought, isn't it?"
Kawakita said. He stood up and went to the coffee machine, beating the last drops out of the urn with a savage blow.
"But not as scary as the thought of being unprepared for my presentation tomorrow."
Margot knew Kawakita, young, fast-track scientist that he was, would never be unprepared for anything.
"Image is everything today," Kawakita went on. pure science alone doesn't get the grants anymore.
Margot nodded again. She heard him, and she heard the swirl of voices around them, but none of it seemed important, except for the blood on Prine's shoes. 5.
Listen up, the policeman said an hour later. You're free to go now. Just be sure to stay out of the areas behind the yellow tape.
Margot raised her head from her arms with a start as a hand landed on her shoulder. Tall, lanky Bill Smithback clutched two spiral notebooks in the other hand, and his brown hair looked, as usual, as if he'd just gotten out of bed. A chewed pencil was tucked behind one ear, his collar was unbuttoned, and his grimy tie knot pulled down. The perfect caricature of a hard-driving journalist, and Margot suspected he cultivated the look. Smithback had been commissioned to write a book about the museum, focusing on the Superstition exhibition that would open next week.
"Unnatural doings at the Natural History Museum," Smithback muttered darkly in her ear as he folded himself into a chair beside her. He slapped his notebooks on the table, and a flood of handwritten papers, unlabeled computer diskettes, and Xeroxed articles covered with yellow highlighting spilled across the formica surface.
"Hello, Kawakita,"
Smithback said jovially, slapping him on the shoulder.
"Seen any tigers lately?"
"Only the paper variety," Kawakita replied dryly.
Smithback turned to Margot.
"I suppose you must know all the gory details by now. Pretty nasty, huh?"
"They didn't tell us anything," Margot said. "All we've heard is some talk about a killing. I guess Prine must have done it."
Smithback laughed. "Charlie Prine? That guy couldn't kill a six-pack, let alone a biped. Nah, Prine just found the body. Or should I say, them."
"Them? What are you talking about?"
Smithback sighed. "You really don't know anything, do you? I was hoping you'd heard something sitting in here for hours."
He sprang up and went over to the coffee urn. He tipped and rattled and cursed it and came back empty-handed.
"They found the director's wife stuffed in a glass case in the primate hall," he said after settling himself in the chair again. "Been there 20 years before anyone noticed."
Margot groaned.
"Let's hear the real story, Smithback," she said.
All right," he sighed. "Around 7:30 this morning, the bodies of two young boys were found dead in the old building basement."
Margot pressed a hand to her mouth.
"How did you learn all this?" Kawakita demanded.
"While you two were cooling your heels in here, the rest of the world was stuck outside on 72nd Street," Smithback went on. "They'd shut the gates on us. The press was out there, too. Quite a few, in fact. The upshot is, Wright's going to give a press conference in the Great Rotunda at 10 to quell the rumors. All that zoo talk. We've got 10 minutes.
"Zoo talk?" Margot pressed.
"It's a zoo around here. Oh, God, what a mess!"
Smithback was savoring not telling what he knew.
"Seems the murders were pretty savage. And you know the press. They've always assumed you've got all sorts of animals locked up in here."
"I think you're actually enjoying this," Kawakita smiled. "A story like this would add a whole new dimension to my book," Smithback went on. "The shocking true account of the grisly museum killings by William Smithback, Jr., wild, voracious beasts roaming deserted corridors. It could be a bestseller."
"This isn't funny," Margot snapped. She was thinking that Prine's laboratory wasn't far from her own office in the old building basement.
I know," Smithback said good-humoredly. "It is terrible. The poor kids. But I'm still not sure I believe it. It's probably some gimmick of Cuthbert's to boost publicity for the exhibition."
He sighed, then started guiltily. "Hey, Margot, I was really sorry to hear about your father. I meant to tell you earlier."
"Thanks." Margot's smile held little warmth.
"Listen, you two," Kawakita said, rising. "I really have to." "I heard you were thinking of leaving," Smithback continued to Margot. "Dropping your dissertation to work at your father's company or something."
He looked at her curiously.
"Is that true? I thought your research was finally getting somewhere."
"Well," Margot said, "yes and no. Dissertation's dragging a bit these days. I've got my weekly 11 o'clock with Frock today.
He'll probably forget, as usual, and schedule something else, especially with this tragedy. But I hope I do get in to see him. I found an interesting monograph on the Kiribitu classification of medicinal plants. She realized that Smithback's eyes had already started to wander, and reminded herself once again that most people had no interest in plant genetics and ethnopharmacology. Well, I've got to get ready. Margot stood up.
Hold on a minute, Smithback said, scrambling to gather up his papers. Don't you want to see the press conference?
As they left the staff lounge, Freed was still complaining to anyone who would listen. Kawakita, already trotting down the hall ahead of them, waved over his shoulder as he rounded a bend and disappeared from sight. They arrived in the Great Rotunda to find the press conference already in progress. Reporters surrounded Winston Wright, director of the museum, poking microphones and cameras in his direction, voices echoing crazily in the cavernous space. Ippolito, the museum's security director, stood at the director's side. Clustered around the periphery were other museum employees and a few curious school groups. Wright stood angrily in the quartz lights, fielding shouted questions. His usually impeccable Savile Row suit was rumpled, and his thin hair was drooping over one ear. His pale skin was gray, and his eyes looked bloodshot.
No, Wright was saying. Apparently they thought their children had already left the museum. We had no prior warning. No, we do not keep live animals in the museum. Well, of course, we have some mice and snakes for research purposes, but no lions or tigers or anything of that sort. No, I haven't seen the bodies. I don't know what kind of mutilation there was, if any. I don't have the expertise to address that subject. You'll have to wait for the autopsies. I want to emphasize that there's been no official statement made by the police. Until you stop shouting, I won't answer any more questions. No, I said we do not have wild animals in the museum. Yes, that includes bears. No, I'm not going to give any names. How could I possibly answer that question? This press conference is over. I said this press conference is over. Yes, of course we are cooperating in every way with the police. No, I don't see any reason why this should delay the opening of the new exhibition. Let me emphasize that the opening of Superstition is right on schedule. We have stuffed lions, yes, but if you're trying to imply... They were shot in Africa 75 years ago, for heaven's sake. The zoo? We have no affiliation with the zoo. I'm simply not going to respond to any more outrageous suggestions along those lines. Will the gentleman from the Post please stop shouting? The police are interviewing the scientist who found the bodies, but I have no information on that. No, I don't have anything more to add, except that we're doing everything we can. Yes, it was tragic. Of course it was.
The press began to fan out, heading past Wright into the museum proper. Wright turned angrily toward the security director.
Where the hell were the police?
Margot heard him snap. As he turned, he said over his shoulder,
If you see Mrs. Rickman, tell her to come to my office immediately.
And he stalked out of the Great Rotunda. 6. Margot moved deeper into the museum, away from the public areas, until she reached the corridor called Broadway. Stretching the entire length of the museum, 6 city blocks, it was said to be the longest single hallway in New York City. Old oaken cabinets lined the walls, punctuated every 30 feet by frosted glass doors. Most of these doors had curators' names in gold leaf edged in black. Margot, as a graduate student, had only a metal desk and a bookshelf in one of the basement labs. At least I have an office, she thought, turning off from the corridor and starting down a narrow flight of iron stairs. One of her graduate student acquaintances had only a tiny battered school desk, wedged between 2 massive freezers in the mammalogy department. The woman had to wear heavy sweaters to work, even at the height of August. The security guard at the bottom of the stairwell waved her on, and she moved down a dim tunnel, flanked on both sides by mounted horse skeletons in ancient glass cases. No police tape was in sight. In her office, Margot dropped her carryall beside her desk and sat down. Most of the lab was actually storage for South Seas artifacts, Maori shields, war canoes, and cane arrows stuffed into green metal cabinets that stretched from floor to ceiling.
a 100-gallon fish tank, a simulated swamp belonging to the animal behavior department, perched on an iron frame underneath a battery of lights. It was so overpopulated with algae and weeds that Margot had only rarely been able to catch sight of a fish peering out through the murk. Next to her desk was a long work table with a row of dusty masks. The conservator, a sour young woman, worked in angry silence, spending what seemed barely 3 hours each day at her task. Margot figured it took her about 2 weeks to conserve each mask, judging by the slow turnover. The particular mask collection she was assigned to contained 5,000 such masks, but it didn't seem to concern anyone that, at the rate she was going, the project would take close to 2 centuries to complete. Now Margot logged onto her computer terminal. A message in green letters appeared, swimming into focus out of the depths of the CRT. Hello, Margot Green, Biotech STF. Welcome back to MuseNet Distributed Networking System, Release 15.5. Copyright 1989 to 1995, NYMNH and Cerebral Systems, Inc. Connecting at 10:24:06, 3:27:95. Print service routed to LJ56. You have no messages waiting. She went into word processing mode and called up her notes, preparing to review them before her meeting with Frock. Her advisor often seemed preoccupied during these weekly meetings, and Margot was constantly scrambling to give him something new. The problem was, there usually wasn't anything new. Just more articles read, dissected, and stuffed into the computer. More lab work. And maybe, maybe, another 3 or 4 pages of her dissertation. She understood how somebody could end up a permanent rider on the government grant gravy train, or what the scientists derisively referred to as an ABD, all but dissertation. When Frock had first agreed to act as her advisor 2 years before, she half suspected some mistake had been made. Frock, intellect behind the Callisto effect, occupier of the Cadwallader Chair in Statistical Paleontology at Columbia University, chairman of the Evolutionary Biology Department at the museum, had chosen her as a research student, an honor awarded to only a handful each year. Frock started his career as a physical anthropologist. Confined to a wheelchair by childhood polio, he had nonetheless done pioneering fieldwork that was still the basis of many textbooks. After several severe bouts with malaria made further field research impossible, Frock diverted his ferocious energy to evolutionary theory. In the mid-1980s, he had started a firestorm of controversy with a radical new proposal. Combining chaos theory and Darwinian evolution, Frock's hypothesis disputed the commonly held belief that life evolved gradually. Instead, he postulated that evolution was sometimes much less gradual. He held that short-lived aberrations, monster species, were sometimes an offshoot of evolution. Frock argued that evolution wasn't always caused by random selection, that the environment itself could cause sudden, grotesque changes in a species. Although Frock's theory was backed by a brilliant series of articles and papers, much of the scientific world remained dubious. If bizarre forms of life exist, they asked, where are they hiding? Frock replied that his theory predicted rapid demise of genera as well as rapid development. The more the experts called Frock misguided, even crazy, the more the popular press embraced his idea. The theory became known as the Callisto effect, after the Greek myth in which a young woman is suddenly transformed into a wild creature. Although Frock deplored the widespread misconceptions of his work, he shrewdly used his celebrity to further his academic efforts. Like many brilliant curators, Frock was consumed by his research. Sometimes, Margot suspected, everything else, including her work, bored him. Across the room, the conservator got up and, without a word, left for lunch, a sure sign that it was approaching 11 o'clock. Margot scribbled a few sentences on a sheet of paper, cleared the screen, and scooped up her notebook. She had some new data about Kirabito plant classification that might intrigue Frock. Frock's office was in the southwest tower, at the end of an elegant Edwardian fifth-floor corridor, an oasis far from the labs and computer workstations that characterized much of the behind-the-scene museum. The heavy oak door of the inner office read simply, Dr. Frock. Margot knocked. She heard a great clearing of the throat and the low rumble of a wheelchair. The door opened slowly, and the familiar, ruddy-complexioned face appeared, bushy eyebrows knitted in surprise. Then his gaze brightened.
Of course, it's Monday. Come in.
He spoke in a low voice, touching her wrist with a plump hand and motioning her to an overstuffed chair. Frock was dressed, as usual, in a somber suit, white shirt, and loud paisley tie. His thick brush of white hair looked ruffled. The walls of his office were lined with old, glass-fronted bookcases, many of the shelves filled with relics and oddities from his early years in the field. Books were piled in enormous, tottering stacks against a wall. Two large bow windows looked out over the Hudson River. Upholstered Victorian chairs sat on the faded Persian carpet, and on Frock's desk lay several copies of his latest book, Fractal Evolution. Next to the books, Margot recognized a large chunk of gray sandstone. Embedded in its flat surface was a deep depression, oddly smudged and elongated along one end, with three large indentations at the other. According to Frock, this was a fossil footprint of a creature unknown to science, the single piece of physical evidence to support his theory of aberrant evolution. Other scientists differed. Many didn't believe it was a fossil at all, calling it Frock's folly. Most of them had never seen it.
"Clear away that stuff and sit down,"
Frock said, wheeling back to his favorite spot under one of the bow windows.
"Sherry?" "No, of course you never do. Silly of me to forget."
On the indicated chair lay several back issues of Nature and the typescript of an unfinished article titled Phyletic Transformation and the Tertiary Fern Spike. Margot moved them to a nearby table and sat down, wondering if Dr. Frock would mention something about the deaths of the two little boys. He looked at her for a moment, motionless. Then he blinked and sighed.
"Well, Miss Green," he said, "shall we begin?"
Disappointed, Margot flipped open her notebook. She skimmed her notes for a moment, then began explaining her analysis of Kirabitu plant classification and how it related to her next dissertation chapter. As she spoke, Frock's head gradually dropped to his chest and his eyes closed. A stranger might think him asleep, but Margot knew Frock was listening with intense concentration. When she finished, he roused himself slowly.
"Classification of medicinal plants by use rather than appearance," he murmured at last. "Interesting. That article reminds me of an experience I had among the Kee tribe of Bechuanaland."
Margot waited patiently for the reminiscence that was sure to follow.
"The Kee, as you know,"
Frock always assumed his listener was as familiar with the subject as he was,
"at one time used the bark of a certain bush as a headache remedy. Charrière studied them in 1869 and noted their use of this bush in his field journals. When I showed up 3/4 of a century later, they had stopped using the remedy. They believed instead that headaches were caused by sorcery."
He shifted in his wheelchair.
"The accepted remedy was now for the kinfolk of the headache victim to identify the sorcerer, and naturally go off and murder him. Of course, the kin of the dead sorcerer were then required to avenge this death, so they often went right back and killed the person with the headache. You can imagine what eventually happened."
"What?" Margot asked, assuming Frock was about to explain how all of this fit into her dissertation.
"Why,"
Frock said, spreading his hands,
"it was a medical miracle. People stopped getting headaches."
His generous shirt front shook with laughter. Margot laughed, too. For the first time that day, she realized.
"Oh, well, so much for primitive medicine," Frock said a little wistfully. "Back then, field work was still fun."
He paused for a minute.
"There will be a whole section on the Kee tribe in the new superstition exhibition, you know," he went on. Of course, it will be terribly played up for mass consumption. They brought in some young fellow fresh from Harvard to curate the show. Knows more about computers and mass marketing than pure science, I'm told.
Frock shifted again in his wheelchair.
In any case, Miss Green, I think what you've described will make a fine addition to your work. I suggest you obtain some samples of the Kiribitu plants from the herbarium and proceed from there.
Margot was gathering her papers when Frock suddenly spoke again.
Bad business this morning.
Margot nodded. Frock remained silent for a moment.
I fear for the museum,
he said finally. Surprised, Margot said, They were brothers. It's a tragedy for the family, but things will die down soon. They always do.
I think not, Frock said. I've heard something about the condition of the bodies. The force used was... of a non-normal nature.
Surely you don't think it was a wild animal? Margot asked. Perhaps Frock was as crazy as everyone said. Frock smiled.
My dear, I make no assumptions. I will await further evidence. For the moment, I simply hope this unpleasantness will not influence your decision on whether to remain with the museum. Oh, yes, I've heard about it, and I was very sorry to get the news of your father's death. But you've displayed three gifts that are indispensable to a first-class researcher. A sense of what to look for, a sense of where to look for it, and the zeal to see your theories through.
He moved the wheelchair closer to her.
Academic zeal is just as important as zeal in the field, Miss Green. Always remember that. Your technical training, your lab work, has been excellent. It would be a shame if our profession were to lose someone of your talents.
Margot felt a mix of gratitude and resentment. Thank you, Dr. Frock, she replied. I appreciate the kind words and your concern. The scientist waved his hand, and Margot said goodbye. But at the door, she heard Frock speak again.
Miss Green?
He asked.
Yes?
Please. Be watchful.
7. Outside, she nearly collided with Smithback. He leaned toward her, winking roguishly.
How about lunch?
No, Margot said, too busy. Twice in one day, she wasn't sure she could stand such a full dose of Smithback.
Come on, he urged. I've got some more grisly details about the murders.
It figures. She quickened her pace down the hall, irritated that her curiosity was aroused. Smithback grabbed her arm.
I hear they're serving a delicious aged and oven-dried lasagna in the cafeteria.
He steered her toward the elevator. The lunchroom was filled with the usual crowd of curators, beefy guards talking loudly, and assorted technicians and preparators in white lab coats. One curator was passing specimens around to a table of fellow scientists who were murmuring in admiration and interest. Margot took a closer look. The specimens were pickled parasitic worms, coiled in jars of cloudy formaldehyde. They sat down, and Margot tried to saw through the crust of her lasagna.
Just as I promised, Smithback said, picking up a piece in his hand and biting off a corner with a crunch. Been on the steam table since 9 o'clock this morning, at least.
He chewed noisily.
Well, the police finally made it official. There were two murders here last night. Brilliant to have figured it out. And you remember all those questions the reporters asked about wild animals? Well, there's also a chance they were mauled to death by a wild animal.
Not while I'm eating, Margot said.
That's right, literally shredded by the sound of it.
Margot looked up. Please.
I kid you not, Smithback continued. And the heat is on to get this thing solved, particularly with the big exhibition coming up. I hear the cops have even enlisted a special coroner, someone who reads gaping claw wounds like Helen Keller reads Braille.
Damn it, Smithback, Margot said and dropped her fork. I'm sick of this, your cavalier attitude and your gory particulars while I'm having lunch. Can't I eat first and hear about this stuff later?
As I was saying, Smithback continued, ignoring the outburst, she's supposedly an expert on big cats. Dr. Matilda Zevich. Some name, huh? Sounds fat.
Despite her annoyance, Margot suppressed a smile. Smithback might be a jerk, but at least he was a funny jerk. She shoved her tray away.
"Where'd you hear all this?" she asked.
Smithback grinned. "I have my sources." He shoveled another piece of lasagna into his mouth. "Actually, I ran into a friend who writes for the